Hey, look, the world's biggest Burger King hat. At last I got a reaction, a slight movement of the lips, accompanied by a determined refusal to laugh. Still heading towards the tunnel that took us under the Thames and south, we came to a petrol station just past the Burger King dome. I needed to call her grandparents. It seemed that fuel was a sideline for this garage. It sold everything from disposable barbecues to lottery tickets and firewood. I undid my seatbelt and tried to sound happy with life. "Do you want anything from the shop?" She shook her head as I got out to use the payphone on the wall. I'd get her something anyway, a nice bundle of kindling, perhaps. After pulling various bits of paper from my jacket pocket, I found Carmen and Jimmy's phone number on a yellow post-it note. Its sticky bit covered with blue fluff from my jacket. Kelly was still sitting in the car, belted up, and staring daggers at me, both for what I had done and what I was about to do. I knew that they'd be in at this time of day. They always had lunch at home. In nearly 50 years of marriage, they'd never eaten out. Carmen didn't like other people preparing her husband's food, and Jimmy had learned better than to argue. I also knew that Carmen would answer the phone. It seemed to be a house rule. "Hello, Carmen. It's Nick. How are you both?"
"Oh, we're fine," she said, a little crisply. "Quite tired, of course," she added, to introduce a tone of martyrdom at the first available opportunity.
I should have ignored it and got straight down to business.
"Tired?"
I asked. And as I said it, I suddenly remembered something.
"Oh, yes. We stayed up until well after news at 10. You said Kelly would be calling us."
They hadn't heard from her since I'd taken her away for the trip, and I'd promised she would call. Mind you, Kelly hadn't exactly gone out of her way to remind me.
"I'm sorry, Carmen. She was so sleepy last night I didn't want to wake her."
She didn't go for that one, and I didn't blame her. She was right. At 10 o'clock last night we were both filling our faces with double whoppers and chips.
"Oh, well, I suppose we can talk to her now. Has she had her lunch?"
What the question actually meant was, "Have you remembered to feed our granddaughter?" My thoughts went out to Jimmy, married to her for half a century, and her son, Kev. No wonder he'd headed west just as soon as he could. I tried to laugh it off, for Kelly's sake. I didn't want to rise to this emotional blackmail.
"Carmen, look, something has come up. I have to go away tonight. Would you be able to have her and take her back to school on Monday?
I was going to take her out for the 5 days to do London, but she might as well go back now." There was excitement in the air, but she still had to carve off her pound of flesh.
"Of course. When will you be coming?"
"That's the problem. I haven't enough time to get her to you. Could you meet us at Gatwick?" I knew they could. In fact, chances were that Jimmy was already being dispatched with an impatient motion of her hand to get his 11-year-old mint-condition Rover out of the garage. The new door that had just been built gave direct access from the bungalow. He was very proud of that. I could picture him in there, wiping any stray finger marks off the paintwork.
"Oh, can't you come here? It would mean we wouldn't get back until late."
They only lived an hour from the airport, but anything to fuck me about.
"I can't, I'm afraid. I'm a bit strapped for time." "But where would we meet you?"
There was an edge of panic in her voice at the thought of having to do something so challenging, mixed with annoyance that today's minute-by-minute routine was being disrupted. It must have been a riot growing up as Mr. and Mrs. Brown's little boy. I'd sensed from the beginning that they, or rather she, didn't really like me. Maybe she blamed me for their son's death. I certainly knew she resented the fact that I was the person he'd appointed as their granddaughter's guardian, even though she knew very well that they were too old to look after her themselves. But fuck it. They'd be dead soon. I would just feel sorry for Kelly when that day came. She needed other people to support her, even if they were as suffocating as the Browns. When I got back to the car, Kelly was pretending to be engrossed in another flyer, and without looking up, she greeted me with a downright martyr's sigh. I'd have to sort her out soon, or she was going to turn out like a poisoned granny. I kept it upbeat. They're really excited about you coming to stay today instead of next weekend. They can't wait to see you and hear all about your time on the ship with everyone.
Okay. That means that I go back to school when everybody else does.
Yes, but you'll have a great time with Granny and Grandpa first. She didn't share my optimism, but she was switched on enough to know that, even though they might be boring, they loved her dearly. It was the only reason I put up with them. We got back onto the main drag and headed for the tunnel, me thinking about the RV details I'd been given. From Kelly there was nothing but brooding, oppressive silence, and I didn't really know how to break it. Eventually I said, "I'll phone you at school one lunchtime next week, okay?" She perked up.
"You will? You'll phone me?"
"Sure I will. I don't know when it will be, but I will." She looked at me and raised an accusing eyebrow.
"Is that going to be another one of your promises?"
I smiled and nodded my head. I knew I was digging myself a very deep hole here, because every time I promised, I seemed to fuck up. I didn't have a clue what I'd be doing, and I knew it was a short-term gain. I hated this part of my responsibilities. I hated letting her down the way I'd been let down. I said, "Not just a promise, a double promise. We'll talk about all the things we'll do on our next holiday. I'll make it up to you, you'll see." She was studying my face, sizing me up. Having gained an inch, she was going to go for the full mile.
"Do I have to go to Granny and Grandad's?"
I could guess how she felt. She'd told me that when she was with them, she spent most of her time pulling her jumper back out of her jeans after Carmen had pulled them up to her armpits to keep out the cold. I wouldn't want to be going there either. But I said, "It'll be fine, don't worry about it. You were going to stay with them next weekend after school anyway. Another weekend won't hurt. I'll have a little chat and see if they'll take you to the aquarium to see those sharks we were talking about." She gave me a look to let me know the aquarium trip wouldn't happen. I knew she was right and ploughed on. "One thing's for sure. I don't want them to take you to the bloody tower. That's our special thing, okay?" There was a slow acknowledgement, even though she probably knew there was more chance of her grandmother metamorphosing into Zoe Ball overnight. I indicated to get off the M23 on the last stretch towards the airport. Signs welcomed us to the north terminal, and I headed up to the short-term parking. I kept up my, "Goodness me, I'm so excited," voice. "Right, let's go and see if Granny and Grandad are here yet, shall we? Tell you what, if they aren't, we'll go and have something to eat. Hungry yet?" That should keep Granny happy. She didn't say it, but the look she gave me as she got out of the car said, "Cut the crap, dickhead. I've had it up to here." She'd been hung out with the washing. She knew it, and she wanted me to know that she knew it. I got hold of her hand and bag, because there was traffic all over the place, and followed the signs to the north terminal. I'd arranged to meet them in the Costa coffee shop. It would be easy enough to find. Even they could do it. I looked at my G-Shock, the one I'd bought to replace the one I'd lost. It was a baby G this time, the new one, and when you pressed the backlight button, a little surfer came up on one of the displays. I quite enjoyed that, even though it was the same little man doing the same little surfing thing every single time. Sad but true. It was just past 1 o'clock. They weren't there yet. Trying to ease my guilt, I took Kelly on a sightseeing tour of the shops, and she landed up with bars of chocolate, an airline teddy bear, and an All Saints CD. It was the easy way out. I knew it wouldn't achieve anything, but it made me feel a bit better. We went back to the Costa coffee shop and sat on bar stools with a view of the terminal entrance. She had an orange, I had a flat white, if that was what they called it, and we both had a sandwich as we sat watching a packed airport get fed, catch planes, and generally spend more money in 1 hour than they would in an entire day on holiday. Kelly said,
"Nick, do you know how long it takes before an elephant is born?"
"Nope." I wasn't really listening. I was too busy bending over my coffee and looking out for Wallace and Gromit, resisting looking at my watch.
"Nearly 2 years."
"Oh, that's interesting," I said.
"Okay, do you know how many people were in the world in 1960?
3 years. She'd suss me out.
"Nick, 3 billion. But very soon the world will have a population of 6 billion.
I turned to look at her.
"You're very clever for a..."
Then I saw what she was doing. Reading facts off the back of sugar packets. "That's cheating." At last I got a smile from her. It turned into an actress's smile when she said through gritted teeth,
"Oh, look, Granny and Grandad."
"Well, off you go then and say hello." Muttering under her breath, she got off her stool and ran over to them. Their faces showed a mixture of relief at finding us and self-congratulation at being brave enough to be out and about in such a big, busy place. Kelly gave them both a hug. She did love them. It was just that they weren't the sort of people you'd want to spend all day with, let alone a bonus weekend. Their trouble was, they didn't actually do anything. They didn't take her to the park or on outings. They just kind of sat there expecting her to draw pictures and drink cups of tea. Jimmy was wearing cream flannels and a beige anorak. Carmen wore clothes from the sort of catalogue that had Judith Chalmers on the cover. Jimmy's face seemed to have no features whatsoever. He looked as if he'd been designed in a wind tunnel. Kev must have got his dark skin and eyes from his mother, who still looked attractive, even if she did believe people really thought her jet-black hair was natural. The pair of them were busy fussing all over her, asking her what she'd done as they walked towards me. I got in there first, flicking my eyes between them as I spoke. "Jim, Carmen, how are things?" And before they could debrief me on the road conditions and the exact routes they'd taken, I got straight down to it. "Look, I'm sorry about this, but I've got to go. You sure you're okay for the rest of the weekend?" They were both very happy. It was like Christmas again, except that that time it had been Heathrow and Kelly had had to be picked up 4 days early. They never understood why someone so erratic had been chosen as her guardian. They didn't even know me, and I was clearly not suited to the task. I bet they had me down as one of Kev's wife's friends. They never did like Marcia. When they weren't blaming me for their son's murder, they were probably blaming her. Not that she was around to answer back. Carmen busied herself doing up the top button of Kelly's shirt and tucking the whole thing back into her jeans. You can't take any chances. The drafts you get in airports. I made sure they saw me take a quick look at my watch. I had loads of time, but it didn't mean I wanted to stay. "I've really got to go now, Kelly. Give us a hug and a kiss." She wrapped her arms around me, and I bent at the waist so we could kiss. Carmen hated that, because Kelly didn't show them the same sort of sustained affection. She did with them only what she knew was expected, and I had to admit that made me feel good. I looked her in the eye and mimed a mock phone call with my hand. "I promise." She raised an eyebrow and gave me a withering look.
"Is that a Nick promise?" she said quietly, so that only I could hear it.
I suddenly saw about 20 years into the future. She was going to grow up into the sort of woman who could light a fire just by looking at it. "No, I said, equally quietly. It's an NPP.
What's that?
Normal person's promise. She liked that one, and nodded. I knew I'd dropped myself in the shit even more, just as my parents had done with me. By now it was almost unbearable. Carmen and Jimmy were uncomfortable with our private intimacy, and I really didn't know how to behave in these situations. I was feeling more guilty than ever. I just wanted to leave. The look on Kelly's face made me remember my 13th birthday. My parents didn't. They made up for it by running to the corner shop and buying a board game in the shape of a robot for 75p. The reason I knew that was because it wasn't even wrapped up, just in a bag with the price tag still on. I knew how it felt to be let down by the ones who were supposed to love you most. I whispered in her ear, "I've got to go." As I stood up, Carmen's nod told me I should have left 10 minutes ago. She said,
"We'll be hearing from you then,"
in that special way of hers that suggested she wouldn't exactly be holding her breath.
"Of course we will, Granny," Kelly said. "When Nick makes a promise, he always keeps it."
She might be lying through her teeth, but she knew when to back me up. I grinned. "Yeah, something like that. Bye now." Jimmy smiled weakly. I couldn't tell if he was happy or just had wind. I couldn't remember the last time I'd heard him speak. Carmen decided it was time for Kelly to cut from me.
"Oh, that's nice. You've got a record, have you?" she said. "Who's it by?" "All Saints." "Oh, they're good, aren't they? My favourite is the ginger one with the Union Jack dress." "That's the Spice Girls." "Oh, is it?"
Carmen glared at me as if it was my fault, then rounded on Jimmy.
"Grandad doesn't like any of them. He doesn't go for all that piercing."
Kelly looked at me and rolled her eyes. As the look changed to one of desperation, I turned on my heel and walked away. Chapter 3 I made as if to go back to the car park, but instead jumped onto the transit train that would take me to the South Terminal. I kept thinking about the fuck-up and how Kelly must be feeling, but I would have to cut from that soon. I decided to use the 2-minute journey to sort out my guilt, then bung the work cassette into the back of my head before I got off the train. The shuttle was full of all the usual airport suspects. Young couples in matching football shirts, him with a team hold-all, her with copies of Hello magazine and word search puzzle books, and businessmen in suits carrying briefcases and laptops and looking in dire need of the Little Book of Calm. I walked into the South Terminal, following the signs to the short-term car park, and took the lift to the top floor. I was in work mode now. Everything else had been put to one side in another compartment. The exposed roof level was about 3/4 full. The deafening sound of aircraft taking off blanketed all the other noises of cars and clattering luggage trolleys. I half closed my eyes to protect them from the glare of sunlight as I started walking down the aisles. In a row of wagons down the middle, I spotted what I'd been told to look for. A Toyota Previa people carrier, dark blue with tinted windows. Maybe the firm had found a use for the ones brought back from Syria after all. It wasn't as if Hertz would have been too happy to have them back. I went to the rear of the row of vehicles and started to follow the line of cars towards it. Since the change of government in 1997, every department seemed to be using people carriers. I didn't know if it was policy or just that Tony Blair used one, but they were a great improvement. Much more room for a briefing, instead of sitting hunched up in the back of a saloon with your knees around your head. Besides, they were easy to find in a hurry. As I got closer, I spotted a driver in the front seat, filling up the right-hand side of the cab area, reading the Evening Standard and looking uncomfortable in his collar and tie. None of the windows were open. The size of his head and his flat-top haircut made it look as if it should have been sticking out of the turret of a Panzer. I approached casually from the rear, checking the number plate. I couldn't exactly remember the full registration, but I knew that it would be a P. The thing I was looking for was the VDM, and sure enough, above the Toyota sign on the bottom left side of the tail was the small chrome outline of a fish, the trademark of heavy-duty Christians. This was the one. I went up to the sliding door on the side and waited, listening to the engine purr. The door opened out a few inches, then slid back to reveal the two rows of passenger seats. I looked inside. I hadn't seen Colonel Lynn for nearly a year, but he hadn't changed much. He hadn't lost any more hair, which I was sure he was happy about. His clothes were the same as always. Mustard-coloured corduroy trousers, a sports jacket with well-worn leather elbows, and what looked like the same viola shirt he'd been wearing the last time we'd met, just a bit more frayed around the collar. I climbed in and slid the door closed behind me. I could feel the air conditioning working overtime as I took my seat next to him and we shook hands. Lynn had that fresh-from-the-shower officer's smell about him. Maybe he'd taken in a quick game of squash at the guards' barracks in Chelsea before coming to the meeting. Between his feet was a dark blue nylon day sack, which I recognised. It was my quick move kit. There was somebody else in there, in the rear row of seats, who I also recognised. I turned and nodded politely at her. She returned the gesture, refolding her copy of the Daily Telegraph. It was only the second time that I'd met Elizabeth Bamber in person. Last time hadn't gone too well. She was on the selection board, which refused me permanent cadre. It seemed that our cultural differences didn't endear us to each other during the interview. Permanent cadre, RKs, deniable operators on a salaried retainer. Not freelancers like me, called on to carry out shit jobs that no one else wants. The pay I got was £210 a day for ops, £160 for training days. I wasn't too sure what the retainer was, but I knew that, like all other payments, it would be handed over in a brown envelope with no tax or national insurance to pay. It was a bit like casual labour, which made me feel used and fucked over. But I liked the money, what there was of it. In any case, it was the only line of work I'd ever known, and I was more afraid of what I would become without it. I didn't know exactly what Elizabeth did, or for whom. All I knew was that she was one of those women who, if they weren't working for the intelligence service, would probably own a stable full of racehorses. She probably did anyway. She had that sort of broken-veined, no-nonsense, out-in-the-fresh-air look about her. She was medium height and in her late 40s, or at least looked it, especially with her shoulder-length hair, which was 60% grey, with a centre parting and a little fringe, though I doubted she gave much of a fuck about it. In fact, having hair was probably a bit of an inconvenience for someone like her, because it took valuable time to comb the stuff. She was wearing a very smart, sensible grey two-piece that looked as if it had cost a fortune. It would have been economical in the long run, however, because she probably wore it every third day, alternating it with the two other equally expensive outfits she bought every year in the Harvey Nichols sale. Under her jacket was a blouse with a long scarf attached, which was tied into a bow. The smart but practical look was complemented by an almost total lack of makeup. It probably took too long in the morning to put it on, and she couldn't be bothered with that. She had a country to protect. I made a half turn back towards Lynn, so that I only had to move my head to see each of them. There was silence for about half a minute, broken by the rustling of a newspaper in the front. I glanced to my left and saw the driver's huge neck sitting on a very wide back and slightly hanging over his collar. I could see part of his face in the rearview mirror. His pale skin and near Slavic looks gave the game away. He was a Serb. No doubt promised passports for his entire family if he spied for us during the Bosnian War. This guy would now be more loyal to the UK than most Brits, myself included. Still, we just sat there. Elizabeth was looking at me. I was looking at her. Come on, I thought. Let's get on with it. It always felt as if they were toying with me. It was Lynn who kicked off. We haven't seen you for a long time, Nick. How's life? As if he cared. No complaints. How long am I going to be away? It will depend on how quickly you can get the task done. Listen to what Elizabeth has to say. Elizabeth was primed, ready to go. She didn't even have notes. She leveled her gaze on me and said, Sarah Greenwood? It was delivered more as a question than a statement, and her eyes narrowed slightly, as if she was expecting an answer. My reaction when I heard the name surprised me. I felt as if I'd just been told I had a fatal disease. My hard drive was spinning. Was she dead? Had she fucked up? Had she got me in trouble? Had she been lifted? I wasn't going to show these people anything more than I had to. I tried to remain casual and unconcerned, but all I really wanted to do was ask, Is she okay? She said, You know her, I believe. Of course I know her. By that name, anyway. I didn't say how I knew her name, or what jobs I'd done with her. I didn't know how much Elizabeth knew, so I just played it straight, which is always the best thing to do. In my experience, the less you say, the less drama you get yourself into. It's good having two ears, but even better to have just one mouth. Well, it seems that she has disappeared, and of her own accord. I looked at her, waiting for the follow-on, but she let it hang. I didn't exactly know what she was getting at, yet she was looking at me as if I should know. Lynn saw the problem. Let me explain, Nick. As I turned my head towards Lynn, I caught him, just finishing eye contact with Elizabeth. He was playing the peacemaker here. He said, 2 years ago, Sarah Greenwood was posted to the Washington desk. You are aware of that? Of course I was. I always tried to keep tabs on where she was and how she was getting on. Though I never kidded myself that the interest was mutual. I'd half hoped that she'd make an appearance during my debrief over last year's fuck-up in the States, but she didn't. I realized he was still waiting for an answer. No, not really. There was a pause as Lynn glanced again at Elizabeth. It looked as if he needed the nod to continue. He must have got it, because he said, Sarah has been UK liaison with the Counter-Terrorism Centre, a new intelligence cell set up by the CIA to provide warnings against potential terrorist attacks. It's a central clearinghouse, if you like, for intelligence on terrorism worldwide. Here is the problem. As Elizabeth has already said, Sarah has disappeared. We know she's still on the US mainland, but we don't know where or why she has gone. We fear that her reliability and judgment are, how shall I say it, in doubt. I couldn't help a smile. That was the standard fuck-off, when what they were really saying was, We don't like you anymore. You have done something wrong and you are no longer one of us. Now it was time for Elizabeth to join in. She said, Let's just say, since her posting in Washington, she has been engaging in too many initiatives of her own. Still looking at Lynn, I smiled again. Oh, I see. Too many initiatives. I gave her word the full five syllables. I hated it when they beat around the bush. Why didn't they just get on with it and tell me what the fuck was happening and what they wanted me to do about it? Before I could get an answer, we were interrupted by the arrival of some punters. Oi! You're not on holiday now. Give Emily sodding bags. All right, don't get out your bleeding pram.
Everything stopped as we all looked over to the driver's side of the wagon. I couldn't see Lynn's face, but Elizabeth's registered disgust. Two couples were standing by a Ford Escort XR3i. While we'd been waffling away, they'd turned up, opened the boot, and were loading their luggage. One couple, both in their mid-twenties, had come to pick up the other one. The girl back from holiday was wearing white, cut-down jeans with half her arse hanging out to show us how brown she was, but the effect was spoiled a bit by all the exposed skin being goose-bumped, what with this being Gatwick rather than Tenerife. Just in case we didn't get the message that she'd been away, her bottled blonde hair was in beads where it had been braided by a beach hustler. Our man in the driving seat was keeping an eye on them continuously, still with the paper up, still on the same page, the skin of his massive neck hanging over his collar even more as he looked right in his wing mirror, checking everything out. These boys had to be jacks of all trades, offensive and defensive drivers, as well as bodyguards to protect their principals, and great joke-tellers to entertain them. Maybe that was why the Serb worked for Elizabeth. She wasn't the sort of person who understood jokes, and, judging by the Serb's expression as he tried to follow the estuary English outside, he wasn't up to speed on banter either. I just hoped he wasn't learning his English from these two in the wagon. People would think that Prince Charles had been hitting the gym. The entertainment was over. We all turned back to our original positions, and Elizabeth carried on, physically affected by what she had just seen. Her breed found such people a terrible stain on their ordered lives.
"We are concerned that there might be a conflict about the ethics of her employment."
I tried not to laugh. "Ethics? That's not Sarah. She's got ethics filed under things to worry about when I'm dead."
I risked a chuckle, but either Elizabeth didn't understand, or she got the joke and didn't like it. The atmosphere felt so frosty I wondered if the Serb had adjusted the air conditioning. I was slowly welcoming myself out of this wagon. Elizabeth continued as if I still hadn't spoken.
"We feel that this could expose current operations and put operators' lives in very real danger."
That stopped me smiling.
"How do you know Sarah might be putting operations at risk?"
"That," she said, "you don't need to know."
I could see she'd enjoyed saying that.
"However, let me give you an example of the problem we face. The information that Sarah Greenwood retrieved from Syria, I understand that you were part of that operation. The material delivered to us was in fact incorrect. It would appear that she quite deliberately distorted information she knew was important to us and the Americans."
So they had wanted what was on the computers after all. And as usual, I'd been one of their mushrooms, kept in the dark and fed on shit. She was on a roll now.
"It was most unfortunate that the source was killed. After all, that was your task, to bring him back. We still don't know what intelligence the Syrian operation would have revealed, because you destroyed the computers on site, I believe."
She made it sound as if I'd done all that on some kind of whim. I let her carry on, but inwardly I was ready to punch her lights out.
"The Americans were not pleased with our efforts, and I have to say it was hardly one of our finest hours."
I wasn't going to let her rev me up even more. For years we'd done jobs for the US that Congress would never sanction, or which were against the 1974 executive order prohibiting US involvement in assassination. The job had been false flagged as an Israeli operation because the US could not be seen to be screaming into Syria and kidnapping an international financier, even if he did happen to be the right-hand man of the world's most prolific terrorist. However, by making it look like a joint operation between the Israeli military and Mossad, everyone was a winner. America would get the source. The UK would have the satisfaction of doing a difficult job well,
and Israel would reap all the kudos. Not that they knew about it when it was happening. They never did. But they would still take all the credit. I thought back to Syria, and Sarah's frantic work on the laptop, and the fact that she had killed the source. Sarah had certainly sounded convincing during the debrief, and after that I didn't even think about it. It was finished. Whatever had happened since then didn't worry me either. It wasn't going to change my life. Well, maybe it was now. Elizabeth continued. She could have caused a major change in foreign policy, and that, I must say, would have been most detrimental to the UK's and US's balance of payments and influence in the region. She was talking crap. I bet the reason she was pissed off was because Clinton had recently signed a lethal presidential order against bin Laden. He had authorized, in advance, an aggressive operation to arrest him if the opportunity arose, at the same time recognizing that some of those involved might be killed. In other words, Clinton had found a way round America's strict anti-assassination rules, and the firm would be done out of some work. I could see that Sarah fucking about wouldn't help matters. I waited for the part Elizabeth had forgotten to emphasize. There are three things they like to give you at a briefing, when they eventually get round to saying what they really mean. 1. The aim of the task. 2. The reason why the task has to happen. And 3. The incentive for the operator. I saw her eyes move fractionally up and to the left. She was lying. As well as putting operators at risk in the area, which is, of course, our most important consideration. Not a bad incentive, I thought, even if she was talking bollocks, especially if it was me operating there. As to her motives, well, that's not for you to worry about. I was starting to feel uneasy about all this. I turned to Lynn. If you were worried about this back then, why didn't you just give her a bung? From behind me, Elizabeth said, A bung? A bung? Lynn looked over my head and said, in the voice of a QC patiently explaining a blowjob to a High Court judge, Money. No, Nick, we didn't offer her a bung. You know as well as I do that the service never bribes or pays anyone off. I couldn't believe he'd said that, and I somehow managed to keep a straight face. Amazingly, so did he. They look after their own in the intelligence service. Even if the IG's been given the sack for gross misconduct, whether it's for being a paedophile and getting blackmailed for it, or for just screwing up the job, he goes into a feeder system where he gets work, and that does two things. It keeps tabs on him, but it also keeps him sweet and, more importantly, quiet. That's what a bung is all about. Keeping the house in order. I wished they would give me one. Only a few months earlier, I'd been escorting an IG called Clive to a service apartment in London. These apartments are paid for, furnished, and run by the intelligence service. Nobody lives in them. They're used for meetings, briefings and debriefings, and as safe houses. Clive had had a bit of a drama with Gordievsky, the Russian dissident who'd years ago defected to the West with a head full of secrets. The former KGB chief was briefing the intelligence service at one of the training establishments near the Solent on the south coast. Clive and two others refused to go to the presentation on the grounds that Gordievsky was a traitor, and it didn't matter which side he came from. I happened to believe they were right, but they still got cut away. After all, it was very embarrassing for HMG to have its people calling an inbound defector a scumbag. Two went quietly with a payoff and job supplied by the Good Lads Club, the city. Clive, however, refused to go. The best way, it seemed to the service, was to offer him a bigger wad than the other two. If that was refused, then he could have as much pain as money can buy. I persuaded him into a flat in Cambridge Street, Pimlico, and listened as they offered him 200 grand to shut up and fuck off to the city. Clive picked up the money, ripped it out of its plastic bank wallet, opened the window and scattered it like confetti. As the hundreds of notes fluttered down onto the corner pub on Cambridge Street, the punters must have thought Christmas had been brought forward to June. "You want to fuck me off?" Clive said. "Then it's going to cost you a fucking sight more than this." I thought it was great, and wanted to join the pub crowd fighting for £50 notes. To my mind, the boy had done good. Nobody likes a traitor, no matter what side you think you're on. I really hoped Sarah wasn't one, because I liked her. Actually, I liked her a lot. I asked Elizabeth, "And you're sure that she hasn't been lifted?" She looked at Lynn. "Lifted?" It was a bit like being at Wimbledon, sitting between these two. Lynn had to interrupt again, because Elizabeth seemed about as switched on to real life as Mickey Mouse. I asked, "So what do you want me to do about it?" Elizabeth kept it very simple. "Find her." I waited for the rest of the sentence. There was nothing. It was the most succinct aim I'd ever been given. "Do you know where she could be? I need a start point." She thought for a while. "You will start in Washington. Her apartment, I think, would be best, don't you?" "Yes, I didn't disagree with that, but I had another question." "Why don't you get the Americans to help you? They'd have the resources to track her down much faster." She sighed. "As I thought I was making clear to you, this matter needs to be handled with the least possible amount of fuss, and speedily." She looked at Lynn. He cleared his throat and turned to face me. "We don't really want to involve any American departments yet. Not even our embassy staff are aware of the situation. As you might imagine, it's somewhat embarrassing to have one of our own IGs missing in the host country. Especially with Netanyahu and Arafat in the US for the WISE summit." He paused. "If you fail to find her, they will have to know, and they will have to take action. This is a very grave situation, Nick. It could cause us a lot of embarrassment." I had been given the shortest aim ever, and now I'd also been told the clearest reason why. Lynn showed the worry on his face. "We need to find her quickly. No one must know. I emphasize, no one." I hated it when these people used the word "we." They're in the shit, and all of a sudden it's "we." If the job went wrong, it would have no father but me. I calmed down. "That's why you want a K. It's a deniable op." He nodded. "Why me?" I said. "Isn't this a job for the security cell? They're used to investigations. This isn't my sort of work." "This isn't something that needs to go any further within the service." There was irritation in Elizabeth's voice. "I particularly wanted you for the job, Mr. Stone. As I understand, you know Sarah better than most." I looked at her, still trying not to show any emotion. She'd raised a knowing eyebrow as she said it. Shit. I tried to look puzzled. "I know her, if that's what you mean. And I've worked with her, but that's about it." She tilted her head slightly to one side. She knew I was lying. "Really? I was informed that the relationship between you was somewhat cozier. In fact, I was told that the reason for your divorce after leaving the military was due entirely to your relationship with Sarah Greenwood. Am I mistaken?" She wasn't, and I now understood even more. They had chosen me because they thought I knew her well enough to have a chance of finding her. They were firefighting, and they were using me as Red Adair. Fuck 'em. Let them sort their own shit out. I might be pissed off, but I wasn't stupid. It was excuse time. It's not going to work, I said. The US is a big place. And what am I going to do on my own? I haven't seen her for ages and we weren't that close. What can I do? What's the use of even getting on a flight? Lynn bent down to pick up my quick move kit. You will be going on the flight. You will start an investigation to find her. If not, I'm afraid you will find yourself in jail. I felt like saying, come off it. That's the sort of line I use myself when I'm threatening people. You can do better than that. But I had learned the hard way to keep my mouth shut. And it was just as well I did. Lynn had my day sack on his knees now. Credit us with a little intelligence, Nick. Do you really think we don't know the full events of last year? My stomach lurched, and I knew my cheeks were starting to burn. I tried to remain calm, waiting to hear what he had to say. Nick, your version of events leaves out a number of details, any of which will put you behind bars if we so choose. We haven't investigated the money you kept, or the unlawful killings you performed. That sounded rich, coming from a man who had sent me out routinely to perform unlawfully. But I knew that they could stitch me up if they wanted. It was par for the course. I'd even been part of the stitch-up sometimes. I now knew how it felt. There was an outside chance they were bluffing. I stared at him, and waited to see what else he had to say. I soon wished I hadn't, because it gave Elizabeth another opening. Mr. Stone, let us consider your situation. What, for example, would happen to the child in your guardianship if you were imprisoned? Her life must be difficult enough as it is, I should have thought. New country? New school? How the fuck did they know all this? I thought I'd already been given my incentive, but obviously not. They didn't come any less subtle than this. I had to clench my fists to control myself. I felt like kicking the shit out of both of them. They knew it, and maybe that was why Godzilla was in the driving seat. It's always unwise to fuck with a man who has a neck bigger than your own head. Especially if he probably has enough weaponry in the footwell to shoot down a jumbo jet. I took a deep breath, accepted I was in the shit, and let it out again. Elizabeth carried on as Lynn opened my day sack. Having found her, report back where she is and what she's doing. Then await further instructions. I turned back to Lynn. I knew she had finished, and he would now give me the details I needed. I could hear the newspaper being unfolded. She was probably checking which of her horses were running tomorrow. I tried to keep my breathing under control. I felt angry and helpless, my two least favourite emotions. Lynn was unloading the bag and handing me the items. My cover documentation, driver's licence, passport, and even an advert for books from a local paper showed that, as from now, I lived in Derbyshire. There were three credit cards. These would have been serviced every month, and used so that I ended up with a normal bill like everyone else. The family who covered for me made sure of that. Years ago, we used to keep all this stuff with us all the time, but there were too many fuck-ups, with people getting corrupt and using the credit cards to pay for new cars and silk underwear for their mistresses. An audit a few years earlier had unearthed 2K operators who had never even existed. And somebody somewhere was drawing off the money. Lynn said, "There's the photography kit, to mac anything down to us." I had a quick look inside. From the way that Lynn said it, I knew he'd just got the briefing on this kit, and it sounded all exciting and sexy. I nodded. "Great, thanks. Here are your flight details, and here are your tickets." As he got them out of the bag, he checked the details and said, "Oh, so you're Nick Snell now?" "Yep. That's me." It had been for quite a while now. Ever since I became operational again after, well, after what I'd thought I'd got away with. Then he produced two flashcards from envelopes and handed them to me. "Your codes. Do you want to check them?" "Of course." He passed the bag to me. I took out the Scion 3C personal organizer and turned it on. I'd been trying to get the new 5 series out of the service, but unless the funds were for building squash courts, it was like trying to get blood from a stone. All the K's would have to put up with the 3Cs they'd bought 2 years ago, and the thing I had was one of the early ones, which didn't even have the backlit display. Their attitude to kit was the same as that of a thrifty mother who buys you a school uniform several sizes too big, only in reverse. I put the cards into both of the ports. It would be no good getting on the ground and finding that these things didn't work. I opened up each one in turn and checked the screen. One just had a series of 5 number sequences. I closed that down and took it out. The other had rows of words with groups of numbers next to each word. All was in order. "The contact number is..." Lynn started to reel off a London number. The Scion held the names and addresses of everyone from the bank manager to the local pizza shop, as you would have as part of your cover. I hit the data icon and tapped the telephone number straight in, adding, as I always did, the address, Kay's Sweet Shop. I could sense Elizabeth's eyes burning into the back of my head, and I turned round. She was looking disapprovingly at me over the top of her paper, clearly put out that I was entering her contact number in the 3C. But there was no way I'd remember it that quickly. I'd need to go away and look at it, and once I had it in my head, I'd wipe it off. I'd never been clever enough to remember strings of telephone numbers or map coordinates as they were given to me. Lynn carried on with the details. "Once in DC, make contact with Michael Warner." He gave me a contact number, which I also tapped in. "He's a good man. Used to work in communications, but had a car accident and needed to have steel plates in his head." I closed down the Scion. "What's he do now?" Elizabeth had finished with the racing section and turned to the share prices. The driver still hadn't turned a page. Either he was learning the recipe of the day by heart, or he'd gone into a trance. Lynn said, "He's Sarah's PA. He'll let you into her apartment." I nodded. "What's the cover story?" Lynn looked impatiently at his watch. Maybe he had another squash game to get to. "He knows nothing, apart from the fact that London needs to check out her security while she's away on business. It's time for her PV review." Personal vetting is carried out every few years to make sure you aren't becoming a target for blackmail, or sleeping with the Chinese defense attaché, unless you've been asked to by Her Majesty's government, or that you, your mother, or your great-aunt haven't chucked in your lot with a monster-raving loony party. Not that that would have meant that much in the past. Once you were in as an IG, things seemed to flow along without much in the way of monitoring, unless you were at the lower end of the food chain, my end, when it was a completely different story. "He is a bit strange at times. You may have to be patient." Lynn started to smile. "He had to leave the comms cell because his steel plates picked up certain frequencies, and he used to get terrible head pain. He's good at his job, though." The smile faded as he added pointedly, "And more important, he's loyal." I shrugged. "Fine." Chances were that Metal Mickey was loyal because he couldn't get a job anywhere else, apart from as a relay station for CellNet. I was packing everything back into the bag. I couldn't wait to get into the fresh air. I was fed up with being scrutinized and fucked over by these people. but Lin hadn't finished. He had one more item, which he shoved right under my nose. It was a sheet of white A4 paper requiring a signature for the codes. I used Lin's pen to scribble mine and handed it back. No matter what happens, you've still got to sign for every single thing. Everyone needs to cover their arse. I pushed open the door and slid it back, picking up the day sack. When my feet were on the concrete, I turned and said, "What if I can't find her?" Elizabeth lowered the paper and gave me the sort of look she'd given our friends in the Ford Escort. Lynn glanced at Elizabeth, then back at me. "Get yourself a good barrister." I picked up the day sack, turned away, and started to walk towards the lift. I heard the door slide closed, and moments later, the Previa moved off. Chapter 4. I walked towards the lift, trying not to get myself into a rage. I didn't know what had brought it back on. The fact that the firm knew about both Sarah and Kelly, or the fact that I'd been stupid enough to think they didn't. I tried to calm down by telling myself that, in their shoes, I would have done exactly the same. Would have used it as a lever to make me do the job. It was a fair one, but that didn't make me any happier about being on the receiving end. I got to the lift and jabbed the button. I looked at the red digital display above the door. Nothing was moving. An elderly couple arrived, having an argument about the way their bags were stacked on the trolley. We all waited. The lift stopped at every floor but ours. I stabbed at the button 6 times in rapid succession, and the elderly couple shut up and moved to the other side of their trolley to keep out of my way. Maybe it was Sarah I was pissed off with. Or maybe I was just pissed off with myself for letting her under my guard. Elizabeth was spot on. She had been responsible for my divorce. The wait for the lift was starting to turn into a joke. More people had arrived with trolleys and were milling about. I took the stairs. 2 levels down, I followed the signs to departures, across the skywalk, fighting my way against a stream of pedestrian traffic with suntans. Several charter flights must have come in at once. I couldn't get the briefing out of my mind. How was it that they knew everything about last year's fuck-up? I'd kept my mouth shut all along and just let them have the barest of facts. There was no way I was going to let them take the money off me. Did they even know about it? I had a brainwave and started to feel better. They couldn't know everything. If so, they would know that I had enough evidence to put a few of the fuckers behind bars forever. And if they knew that, they wouldn't risk threatening me. Then I felt pissed off again. They could do what they wanted because they knew about Kelly. I'd seen grown men's emotions getting fucked over and used against them when it came to their kids. But I'd never thought it would happen to me. I cut all the conjecture from my mind and started working. Departures was the normal mayhem. People trying to steer trolleys that had other ideas, and parents chasing runaway 2-year-olds. A gaggle of pubescent school kids with tin grins were on a trip somewhere, and an American kids' orchestra was sitting on their trombone and bassoon cases, bored with waiting to check in. I went to the cash point, then to the Bureau de Change. Next priority was to find myself some plausible hand luggage. I bought myself a leather holdall, threw in my quick-move day sack, and headed for the pharmacy for washing and shaving stuff. After that, I hit a clothes shop for a pair of jeans, a couple of shirts, and spare underwear. I checked in at the American Airlines business class desk and fast-tracked airside into the lounge, where I got straight on my mobile to contact my family. They were good people, James and Rosemary. They had loved me like a son since I boarded with them years ago, or that was the cover story anyway. James always seemed like a father should be. He was certainly the sort of man who would have taken his 8-year-old around HMS Belfast. Both civil servants who had taken early retirement, they had never had any children because of their careers, and were still doing their bit for Queen and country. I even had a bedroom. They called it Nick's room, in the loft. If all your documentation shows that's where you live, you must have a room, surely.